From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
Darling, you send me, I know you send me. Darling, you send me, honest you do, honest you do, honest you do.
You Send Me in the velvet voice of an era's Mr. Soul, Sam Cooke. Released in 1957, You Send Me was his first hit, and it was huge. In a flash, Sam Cooke was at the top of American pop charts, and he stayed there. Only Elvis sold more records. Born in 1931 in Clarksdale, Mississippi, the son of a preacher, Sam Cooke came into the world singing praise. In 1950, the 19-year-old joined the legendary Soul Stirrers and revolutionized gospel music. 6 years later, Cooke, like Ray Charles, pushed his gospel roots into soul, into pop, and into the American mainstream. He sang beautifully, he was beautiful, he was ambitious, and he was fully aware of what it meant to be black in the heart of the civil rights era and making white kids dance and swoon. You Send Me went number one and sold over 2 million copies. Then came Cupid, Only 16, Bring It On Home to Me, a mountain of jukebox standards, and his great anthem of the civil rights movement, A Change Is Gonna Come. The life ended in 1964 when he was shot dead in a Los Angeles motel. Sam Cooke was 33. The music went on. This hour on Point, the celebrated music biographer, Peter Guralnick, on the life and legacy of the great Sam Cooke. You can join the conversation. Did you grow up with Sam Cooke, with Chain Gang and Twistin', and don't know much about geography? Can you hear the gospel roots? Did you hear them then? Can you hear a black man taking on a white world with beauty? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Peter Guralnick. He's one of America's most respected music writers. His sweet soul music, rhythm and blues, and the southern dream of freedom is a classic. He's written award-winning books on soul music and the blues. His two-volume biography of Elvis Presley, Last Train to Memphis, and Careless Love are considered the definitive biographies of Elvis. Peter Guralnick's new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. Peter Guralnick, welcome to On Point.
Well, thanks very much. It's great to be back.
It's wonderful to have you. Great to have you writing again. And what a golden voice, what a golden boy, golden man. It's a checkered story, but this guy, Sam Cooke, just emanated golden light somehow. What was it about him?
I think it was everything. I mean, it was, first of all, an intelligence, a driving intelligence and a driving creative force that impelled him forward at every stage in his life and his career. I mean, to Sam, life was a series of lessons, in a sense, and as each one was absorbed, I mean, he absorbed them like litmus paper, and once absorbed, he moved on. There was no limit to his ambition. There was no sense of placing limits on himself or allowing anyone else to place limits on him. And above all, there was the talent, this incredible talent, not just for singing. I mean, Ray Charles said about him that he was the one and only. He hit every note. And what's more, he hit every note with feeling. And then Ray said to me, he says, and you know I don't hand out praise lightly. And believe me, Ray didn't.
Yes.
But in addition to the voice and in addition to good looks, which allowed him to really to appeal equally across the board to black and white, he also had an imagination and an intellectual curiosity that led him to write some of the most memorable songs of a generation, songs that he saw as the equivalent of the writing of Gershwin, of Irving Berlin, of Harold Arlen, in a completely different idiom, but his ambition was no less.
Walk us through some of those at the very top of the Sam Cooke range. There are so many, it's kind of mind-blowing when you look at all the songs he wrote that are just part of our kind of cultural bedrock now, but the ones that really turned the country's head.
Well, I mean, you know, you mentioned so many of them. I mean, Change Is Gonna Come, for example, mm-hmm. which came at the end, was an immediate anthem of the civil rights movement and summarized in the simplest terms and within a narrative framework that Sam felt would be accessible to every black man and woman who had grown up in the 20th century, summarized the experience, the African-American experience in America in the first half of the 20th or in the 20th century. But songs like Wonderful World were so charming.
Don't know much about geography, don't know much about biology, yeah.
And, you know, he started out with a song that his friends, Lou Adler and Herb Alpert, who worked at the record company Keen with him, they had written this song, had given up on it, just saw it as being trite and you know, having no potential.
Right.
And Sam kept coming back to them. He says, would you mind if I worked on that song? And as both Lou and Herb said, and Lou and Herb achieved, you know, the very pinnacle in pop music in different ways. I mean, I think most listeners would be aware of them. But the point is, both of them said that Sam added something incalculable to their song. He simply added something they hadn't even known was there and became the principal author of it and wrote a song which has never gone away. I mean, it's a song which, if you went out on the street and you encountered 10 people who had never heard of Sam Cooke, 9 of them would have heard that, would recognize that song.
And on and on and on, twist in, and another Saturday night, and Cupid, pull back your bow. And all of that growing out of this childhood and youth steeped in gospel. I want to play a 1955 song from the Soul Stirrers, kind of the pinnacle of Cooke's songwriting to that date. Listen with us to Nearer to Thee, if you would, Peter Grunlich, and we'll talk about it in a moment.
Congregation was singing a tune in a voice that was loud and clear. You know the crowd that stood around him, they were crying, I could plainly see, for the song that they sang was touching. They were singing, nearer my God.
There's Sam Cooke, before he goes pop, before he goes mainstream, before he takes over white American jukeboxes and black American radios, leading there, the lead singer for the Soul Stirrers. Peter Grunlich, talk to us about how Sam Cooke came to be in a gospel group and what he brought to gospel, what the Soul Stirrers brought to gospel.
Well, the Soul Stirrers were the number one group quartet, or at least among the number one groups in the country when Sam Cooke joined them in December of 1950. They had had one of the greatest lead singers in history, R.H. Harris, whose yodel was an effortless leap into the falsetto. And R.H. Harris was a hard singer, much harder singer than Sam Cooke, but just a classic gospel singer. He left the group in the fall of 1950, and the second lead, Paul Foster, who you can hear on all of Sam's Soul Stirrers sides, and was a tremendous second lead, couldn't carry the lead. So in December, Sam joined the group. He had been singing with a teenage group called the Highway QCs, a great group.
Had that grown out of his church childhood and his father's preaching, or was this more strictly an entertainment play in Sam's mind?
No. I mean, the Highway QCs were part of a movement and in the late 40s, a teenage gospel movement that appeared to be something that would sweep the country. All the greatest singers were in these teenage gospel groups, and Sam joined because the Richards brothers, Lee and Jake, heard him singing to a girl in a hallway in a house in an apartment house near where they lived on Rhodes, I think 36th and Rhodes, and he was singing an Ink Spots number, and they were so impressed that they fell in behind him. They started harmonizing behind him. If this is if I didn't care, and then they asked him if he was with a group, and he said no, and they said why don't you join our group, which wasn't named yet, and that became the Highway QCs.
So from Highway QCs, he's brought into the Soul Stirrers as the guy who can do it. In what direction did he take this big gospel group?
Well, the direction he took them in, and it was much to everybody's surprise, was a direction. It was almost he was a crooner in a world of hard shouters. Crane was a hard singer. Somebody like Archie Brownlee with the Five Blind Boys of Mississippi was one of the greatest singers of all time, but he was a screamer. He was a shouter.
The old-time testifying.
Yeah. No, I mean, like the Mighty Clouds of Joy today, like Joe Lagon. And this is a tradition which is it's overpowering. It's not anything that is – I'm not speaking of that as being any less than what Sam did. But what Sam did essentially was to lower the tone. And he introduced a seductive note into gospel singing. He saw himself almost as a crooner. And he had been influenced not just by the Ink Spots, but by Bing Crosby and by Gene Autry as well. He liked that kind of music, that mellowness. And as Bobby Womack said, this crooning took on a very seductive tone when Sam sang it. And as Bobby Womack said, he brought sex into the church.
And sex in a narrative, a kind of storytelling beyond simply testifying.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, everything about Sam's songwriting, and Nearer to Thee is a very good example of it, because it's patterned after the same sort of, in the same way that Irving Berlin's always is. It uses the phrase, the old hymn, Nearer, My God, to Thee, as a phrase that's repeated all through the song, and with each repetition it changes meaning and it adds emotional layers. Mm. But he was very serious about his songwriting and brought a great deal of craft to it. But I think more than anything, what his singing was what put it across, and as so many people who sang with him, who sang against him in these gospel competitions, as they said, he could take off from the song. He could just, improvise on the song, take off in an emotional way, but he always came back right to the spot where he was supposed to be.
Sam Cooke, who brought sex into the church and gospel into mainstream American music, right alongside Ray Charles. My guest is Peter Guralnick. His new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. It's a complicated story. We're to come right back into it. You can join us. Did you grow up on Sam Cooke, on You Send Me and Chain Gang and Twistin'? Is this the sound to you of a white sock hop or a black emergence? We're at 1-800-423-8255. We'll go out with, just for you, a 1959 recording released in 1961 on Sam Cooke's own label. We'll get to that as well. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about Sam Cooke and the gospel to soul to pop stardom journey of a music legend. Peter Guralnick is with us. He's written huge biographies of Elvis Presley, written about music upside and down of the 20th century. Now he's out with a new biography of Sam Cooke. It's called Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke, and it's a heck of a story. You can join our conversation. What do you think? Can you hear now, did you hear then, the religious ecstasy of gospel poured into the jukebox ecstasy of pop music of Sam Cooke? And is this good times music or the sound of black empowerment in the music business or both? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's hear a little bit more of that voice. This is That's Where It's At from 1964, a song Sam Cooke wrote for the Sims Twins. He re-recorded it himself in 1964, the year of his death, with Bobby Womack. He slowed the song down, turned it into a melancholy meditation on the passage of time. Sam Cooke, 1964, That's Where It's At. Peter Guralnick, there's a lot we want to hear, but we've got a mountain of callers already dying to get in here with us, and I want to just start to turn to them. Larry is calling right now from Thule Air Base, I guess Air Force Base, in Greenland. Larry, we're going to put you right at the front of the line. What do you know, my friend? Hello, Larry, are you there?
Good day, Mr. Ashbrook, and I'd like to say good day to Mr. Guralnick.
Hi.
I remember Mr. Cooke's music in my younger days as a high school student at Fremont High in Los Angeles, which was about 2 miles from the motel which Mr. Cooke met his demise.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd just like to say that he was such a clean-cut and smooth individual, and I think that's what helped transcend some of the barriers and racial lines that existed at the time.
What do you think he meant to the black community of those years, Larry?
Wow. At that time, I really have to say that I think he meant more to individuals like my parents and their generation. Like you indicate, the civil rights movement was in its relative infancy at that particular time, and he was just a force.
Did people find hope by his music? Did people find hope in his success, in his joy?
I would agree with that.
Well, there's a shout out from Greenland, Larry. Thank you very much for calling in from Thule Air Base in Greenland. Peter Guralnick, I want to get right into the kind of heart of where you see Sam Cooke in the whole social water of that day. In your author's note, right at the start of the book, you've got a wonderful passage here, the very first paragraph of the book, where you lay it out in a terrific context. And I wonder if you'd just read that first long paragraph for us.
Sure, I'd be glad to. Sam Cooke was born into a world defined but not limited by its separateness, a world of two-ness, as W.E.B. Du Bois wrote in The Souls of Black Folk, in which it was impossible to avoid this sense of always looking at oneself through the eyes of others, of measuring one's soul by the tape of a predominantly white society that looks on in amused contempt and pity. It was a world, as Du Bois also recognized, so rich, so vibrant, so colorful, that thrown back on its own resources, it created a culture that has in many respects, both with and without acknowledgement, defined the American cultural mainstream. This was a community in which imagination and self-invention trumped pedigree, in which, as James Baldwin wrote, there existed a zest and a joy and a capacity for facing and surviving disaster, very moving and very rare. Perhaps we were all of us, Baldwin reflected in The Fire Next Time, pimps, whores, racketeers, church members, and children, bound together by the nature of our oppression, the specific and peculiar complex of risks we had to run. If so, it was that inescapably shared heritage, Baldwin went on, that helped create the dynamic that allowed one to respect and rejoice in life itself and to be present in all that one does, from the effort of loving to the breaking of bread. It was that freedom, that presentness, that vitality which Sam Cooke sought to celebrate. It was that experience which he sought both to embody and transcend.
It's a terrific passage. Peter Guralnick reading from his new book, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. And you take the title of the book from a Langston Hughes poem named Dream Boogie. It starts out, "Good morning, Daddy. Ain't you heard the boogie-woogie rumble of a dream deferred? Listen closely. You'll hear their feet beating out and beating out. You think it's a happy beat?" That question mark comes in there about whether it's happy, not happy. And there you find your dream boogie. There may be the spirit of some of Sam Cooke as well. There is so much joy in these songs. They're so luminous. Are you pointing, in your reference to Langston Hughes, to a dark edge in there as well?
Well, I'm pointing to two things. I mean, one is the collision between the private and the public, the sense in which the black culture was the underpinning in so many ways for the movement, and the movement grew out of a world and out of a culture that was so rich and so vibrant, as James Baldwin described it, that world and that culture supported the movement and urged it forward, and that it almost, the music, the culture, are indivisible from the movement. The other thing is that two-ness, which W.E.B. Du Bois writes about and which is referred to in the poem. And it's that sense, I mean, underlying all of Sam Cooke's songs, even the most celebratory songs, is a melancholy tone. Now, Alan Toussaint pointed out to me that comes from the sixth chord, which Sam falls back on in almost every song. But there's an undercutting in a sense of the explicit sense of the words, whether it's in Having a Party or Nothing Can Change This Love. I mean, you think you're hearing something that's altogether positive, or that's where it's at. And yet underneath that is a sense of time passing, a sense of the evanescence of time, a sense of it's almost a sense of lyric poetry that lies underneath, and a sense of deep-seated melancholy. And what that melancholy springs from, whether it's the public or the private, I'm not sure. But it's unique to Sam Cooke.
There's a song I want to bring in here. It's not actually Sam Cooke singing. It's "Jesus Be a Fence Around Me" from 1961. But it does feature his songwriting, and he's producing here. Of course, he ultimately had his own label. And here the lead singer is, remind me, is this Jimmy Outler?
This is Jimmy Outler, and he had just come into the group replacing Johnny Taylor. And just as Sam had written a new song for Johnny Taylor, Stand By Me Father, which he felt would be something that could introduce gospel to the, you know, to the pop world.
Mm-hmm.
When Jimmy Outler came in with a slightly different sound, then Sam wrote a song to introduce him to the world as well.
So here,
that's what this song is.
Sam Cooke had made his passage to the pop world, and we'll talk about how he did that. But here he's bringing back the kind of gospel sound into that pop mm-hmm. mainstream we're working to. And you can hear, at least I heard maybe, especially a black man saying, "Jesus, be a fence around me in a tough time." Let's listen.
I wonder if there anybody here who late at midnight shed bright and tears, oh, because you didn't have no one to help you along the way. And oh Lord, and if there is anyone, whoa, let me tell you, let me tell you what I've done. I've asked Jesus to be a fence around me and protect me every day.
Jesus, be a fence around me and protect me every day, sung there by Jimmy Outler. But it's a Sam Cooke song, and I have to say, Peter Guralnick, I begin to hear little touches of somehow Otis Redding between the lines of this song and the sound of this song.
Well, Otis came directly out of Sam. I mean, Sam Cooke was Otis Redding's idol, just as he was Solomon Burke's, Joe Tex's, Don Covey, who wrote so many of the songs. I mean, Sam provided the template for soul, and actually the song that you played earlier, that's where it's at, is almost the prototype of so many of the songs that Solomon and Otis later would sing, I mean, in the immediate aftermath of that. But this is just, it's as if in, with his label and by continuing his work with the Soul Stirrers, with the Sims Twins, with the Valentinos, who were the Womack brothers, Sam found another voice for himself, and one which, as you said, here he reintroduces his gospel voice. From his point of view, he never left gospel, mm-hmm. and he continued to appear with the Soul Stirrers. But yet here he is with Jesus Be a Fence, which is a gospel standard today. But he's able to give voice to another form of self-expression through somebody else's interpretation.
Peter, describe for us how Sam Cooke saw his migration from the gospel world and the Soul Stirrers onto the top of the pop charts. Was it deliberate? Was that what he was aiming for all along? Was there a moment when he saw America's changing and a great black singer like me can go right to the top in practical terms and in terms of how he understood what he was doing? Describe that passage for us.
It's all of those things that you said. I mean, first of all, the economic opportunities, the opportunities to get ahead, were the primary motivation. He had simply hit a wall in gospel, and as much as he loved gospel music, as much as he felt he never left it, and he never did, at the same time, he was limited in terms of the audience. It would never reach beyond a strictly black audience. He was limited in terms of the economic opportunities. And this went against the grain, both of the entrepreneurial spirit that his father had given to him, which is, you know, you want to get as far as you possibly can, and yep. in terms of this whole idea of having limits set on him or setting limits on himself. But the thing that really was the spirit of Sam crossing over, even though it took a year and a half before he finally did, was the success of Ray Charles's I Got a Woman in early 55.
Mm-hmm.
And this had a cataclysmic effect. I mean, here was Ray singing a song that was directly translated from the gospel. It actually came from a song called It Must Be Jesus by the Southern Tones,
yeah. mm-hmm.
which was a version of There's a Man Going Around Taking Names. And it was note for note the same thing, and nobody missed it. Whether they knew the original song or not, nobody missed the source. And the point, mm-hmm. this caused preachers to denounce mm-hmm. Ray Charles. Big Bill Brunsey, the blues singer, said, you know, he should be singing in a church. He's crying sanctified, you know. But
yeah.
but the point is, the commercial opportunities of this were lost on no one, neither the singers nor the record company owners, and everyone was looking for someone to sing in this style. Now, specialty.
These songs of love, these religious songs, songs of love of a Savior, of Jesus, and we've heard on this show with other guests, Mavis Staples and others, how you could just kind of plug you in instead of mm-hmm. Jesus, and it made an ecstatic love song. Did Sam Cooke see that as an explicit formula here? Take the gospel song, plug in the you, darling, and you're on your way?
I don't think it was quite that way. I mean, actually what happened was Specialty signed Little Richard as their answer to Ray Charles shortly thereafter, and Little Richard used the ecstatic whoops of Alex Bradford, for example, and combined those with his own very secular message. I mean, but the message was not a direct translation of the gospel lyrics. What I think Sam saw, this was an opportunity to get ahead, and the only thing that held him back, and it held him back for a year and a half, And he really debated within himself. He had a lot of pressure from outside sources to cross over. But what held him back was the thought, and this was an uncharacteristic moment of self-doubt, was the thought that, okay, if I cross over, what if I don't make it?
Yeah.
Where does that leave me? I mean, you know, could I ever go back? I mean, I've got something really great here. I love, you know, singing gospel music. I love the gospel world.
He was afraid to be seen as corrupted if he went to the pop stream and he couldn't go back into the church at that point? Is that the fear?
I think he felt that he feared. It didn't work out that way, despite the popular myths. Sam was always welcomed back into the church. He continued to sing from the time he crossed over. He continued to sing with the Soul Stirrers at different programs, both formally and informally. But he feared, and that's why I say it's an uncharacteristic moment of self-doubt, because I can't think of any other hesitation in his life.
Yeah.
He feared that he would lose the church audience by crossing over, and if he didn't succeed, in the pop world, he would just be left in a no-man's land.
And, of course, instead, he was left in the middle of a giant nation that just picked him up and loved it like crazy. Chris is calling from Arlington, Massachusetts. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. What do you think, Chris?
Oh, well, I was, when I heard that that Fear was going to be on, I was just thrilled, because I've always felt that Sam hasn't really gotten a wide enough recognition over the years. And just wanted to share on a personal level, I grew up with four musical heroes, Elvis, Chuck Berry, Little Richard, and Sam Cooke.
Yeah.
And for me, later in life, I really discovered that I loved two of these guys, Elvis and Sam, even more by discovering their early stuff. And it was a couple years ago that I discovered the Soul Stirrers, which to me was a parallel to finding Elvis's Sun Sessions from years ago. And I said, man, these two of these guys were just amazing and laid such a groundwork for so many other people. Inspiration.
Amen to that. And do you still listen, Chris, or is it something that plays in the back of your head, or do you actually put it on?
Sam's Soul Stirrers are on my iPod, if we can meld generations there.
All right. He's migrated once again. Chris, thanks very much for your call. Peter Grelick, you write about the sort of world in which Sam Cooke moved, the people that he moved with, some very prominent in the civil rights movement, others very prominent in the arts movement of that time. What about that milieu, the folks he intersected with?
Well, it was a world of segregation really forced this kind of intimacy and this kind of connection on everybody, because everyone stayed at the same motels, you know, same colored motels, if there was room.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone ate at the same restaurants. Everyone was forced into the same, living areas. I mean, places like Central Avenue in Los Angeles, 125th Street in Harlem. I mean, these were places of such, they were teeming with activity, teeming with life.
And who was there? And, who was the everyone?
Well, I mean, let's say when Sam arrives in New York with the Soul Stirrers in 1956 to play the Apollo for the first time, who's on 125th Street? Malcolm X. And he met Malcolm X at that time, and he grew to know Malcolm X to one degree or another, until finally, when Cassius Clay fought Sonny Liston in Miami for the championship in February of 64, Malcolm X is with Cassius Clay. Sam, Malcolm X, the great football player Jim Brown, and Clay, I mean, because he was not yet Ali, skipping all the big victory parties at the Fountain Blow, everything that had been planned, they go back to Malcolm X's hotel room at the Hampton House in a black section of Miami. And they meet and they talk about the future and the state of the world and the state of American society. And there's an FBI informer at that meeting who reports back with great concern to J. Edgar Hoover that this intersection of the, entertainment and sports stars, who knows where this could lead.
Could be explosive. And in fact, it was, though probably not how J. Edgar Hoover might have imagined. Peter Grelick, stand by. Peter Grelick's new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. You can join us. Lots of questions here. What do you think? Can you feel the tension of singing from the top of the charts, which meant white, and being black in 1959, 1960, 1963? You can join us, 1-800-423-8255. We'll go out with Having a Party from 1962, Sam Cooke.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com, and Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital. For more than 60 years, helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
I want you to listen to this song right here for me.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Here's Sam Cooke's live 1963 version of Bring It On Home to Me, recorded at Miami's Harlem Square Club.
Baby, if you ever change your mind about leaving me behind, oh, bring it to me. Bring your sweet love.
Sam Cooke, live 1963 in Miami. I don't know if you can fully hear the kind of swooning sound of the crowd going on there at the Harlem Square Club in Miami. My guest is Peter Guralnick. His new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. And in that crowd response of what I think was a largely black crowd, you tell us, Peter.
Entirely black, yeah.
And at the same time, this much more rough and raw version of Bring It On Home, you hear it in the voice of Sam Cooke. Did he play the world in two ways? Was there a Sam Cooke for the white world and a Sam Cooke for the black world?
Well, I think absolutely. I mean, this is on the Chitlin' circuit. This is recording. I mean, he turns his songs upside down, and he did it, in fact, after touring England with Little Richard and feeling like Little Richard was just getting across every night, just killing him every night with his energy. And he and J.W. Alexander came back and wrote a new act, which essentially it's almost like Bob Dylan reinventing the songs. The song you're not playing is the intro to this Bring It On Home to Me is a testifying version of You Send Me, which is just unlike anything that anybody's ever heard with respect to You Send Me. But I wouldn't say it's just the black and white worlds, because the point is, within a month and a half after recording this at the Harlem Square Club in Miami, he goes in and records his one extended masterpiece, Nightbeat, which is a concept album and a kind of tribute to Charles Brown and to this mellow, late-night, wee-wee hours kind of blues. And it's the smoothest, mellowest, most beautiful. I think you said you were going to play Lost and Looking from that album. But it sounds like a different singer. Yeah. And it's not aimed at a white audience. It's aimed at Sam's audience. It's aimed at self-expression, just as this is.
We'll hear a little more Lost and Looking from that Nightbeat album in a moment. But here, let's get some more of Sam in Miami, 1963 Live.
Yeah, say yeah.
Well, take that, Little Richard. We've got Roger calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Roger. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. How y'all doing?
We're well. What do you think, Roger?
Oh, it's a great program. I'm from Mississippi, same area. In fact, I used to live in Clarksdale, and I was telling
you. No kidding.
Before,
wonderful. Yeah.
You know, before Sam, you know, Clarksdale, you had some John Lee Hooker and Ike Turner. Well, not before Sam, because Sam was... grew up in Chicago, but Ike Turner, John Lee Hooker, Joe Hinton, Charles Wright, Watts, but 113th Street, whatever band it was. You know, they had to leave in order to make it because everybody was, you know, was poverty stricken. If you were black, you were tied to the land. And, you know, before Sam recognized his first record, I forget what it was, but he made it under his L.C. Cook's name, probably the gentleman... I remember that.
Peter Guralnick, a first album under L.C. Cooke?
No, the first record, you know.
First record.
Yeah, when he first started singing. First time I remember, you know, I found out later, you know, it was supposedly L.C. Cooke, but it was Sam Cooke. You know, he was still with the Soul Stirrers.
Roger, stick with us. Peter, what can you tell us there?
Well, I mean, what happened was that Sam was still wavering on crossing over, and in December of 56, he recorded a translation of his big gospel hit, Wonderful, as a pop song, Lovable. And I think what the caller is referring to is he put it out under the name of Dale Cooke. This is one of the few cases where he really was hedging his bets. And it was unmistakable that it was Sam Cooke. Not only was it the Soul Stirrers' big hit of that day and the identical song, but how could you mistake Sam Cooke's voice? And it came out under Dale Cooke. And I think Sam, in the back of his mind, was thinking, well, maybe they'll think it's a cousin. If it doesn't work, maybe they'll think it's a cousin who sounded just like me. But nobody missed the point. Now, The L.C. Cooke thing is actually when Sam put out You Send Me, because of a well, this has to do with his taking charge of his business.
His brother was L.C., of course.
He assigned the authorship to L.C. Cook because he had signed a songwriter's contract, which put him, he realized very quickly, put him at a severe disadvantage. But L.C. had not signed that songwriter's contract, so Sam remembered. He said, "Well, no, I didn't write that song. You know, my brother. I just remember my brother L.C. did."
The more I think about it, right?
Right. But a lawsuit ensued for the next year and a half. But in the end, the judge declared, after L.C. sang the song in chambers, the judge declared, "It's a wise father who knows his own child," and L.C. was declared the songwriter.
Oh, there's a picture, Roger. Let me ask you. You're from Clarksville, Mississippi, originally. What did it mean to you?
Greenwood. I worked in Clarksville.
Okay, Greenwood. Yeah. Not far. What did it mean to you at that time to see somebody like Sam and the others that you string off for us, you know, rising up out of Clarksville and getting this kind of national acclaim?
Clarksdale,
excuse me.
Uh-huh. Oh, I was happy. And in fact, my cousin left Macon, Mississippi, and he knew Sam personally because he was with the guy by the name of Wiley. He called himself Wiley Dixon. His name was really Willie Dixon, but his uncle, who was entertainer and bland, who already had famous, he went on Wiley Dixon, but Wiley Dixon with the, he sang with the Traveling Kings with the gospel group, and then it became Semtec and Wiley. Got to Get Over the Hump was his biggest record, you know. So
I love it. Maybe you had to be Wiley, and up they came, Sam Cooke right at the front. Roger, thank you for your call. Peter Gronlich, I'd like you to speak about a couple things and maybe how they go together here. One about Sam Cooke's beauty, and the other about Sam Cooke's anger. You tell a story of when he was pulled over by a white policeman in Memphis, that he could use that beauty, which was so luminous on stage, and even in these songs you can kind of pick it up. He could use it as a weapon almost as well. Could you tell us that?
Well, I think when his car broke down in Memphis, now we can't tell the story, I'm expurgated on the air, but when his car broke down in Memphis, his brother Charles went to get gas, and Sam was left there, and a white policeman came along and said, you know, now, boy, you know, you move that car. And Sam, just to put it in brief terms, I mean, Sam said, you know, I'm a singer. I don't move cars. Mm-hmm. And the policeman said, maybe you didn't hear what I was saying, boy. You know, you move that car. And Sam said, you know, you wouldn't ask Frank Sinatra to move the car if it's so important you move the car. And finally, Sam said, I'm Sam Cooke. You may not know who I am, but your wife does. Go home and ask your wife about me. So I don't know about that being – I'd say that's the kind of thing where you see Sam's anger showing itself, and showing itself fairly recklessly. This is back in 59, 60 in Memphis. That could have gotten him killed. But those flashes of anger, even in the midst of the most smooth, urbane, sophisticated, intellectual kind of approach, those flashes of anger showed up not just in racial situations. I mean, the guy came up to him at the Palm Cafe in New York, just down from the Apollo, and he was drunk, and he says, you know, you're not Sam Cooke. Prove to me you're Sam Cooke. And Sam Cooke says, I don't have to prove nothing to you. He says, nah, if you're Sam Cooke, sing me some songs. And Sam had him down on the floor within seconds and wouldn't let him up until he apologized. And again, that's both, you can say it's principled behavior. Yeah. I mean, his father had taught him never allow yourself to be disrespected, never allow yourself to be played, but it's also somewhat reckless behavior.
So there was anger, there was ambition, and he went far with that as well. There was sorrow. He lost a son, drowned in a swimming pool. A son, and this was a wild time, a wild world. He refused to be quite certain that he had sired this son.
Yeah, no, he was, Sam married his wife, Barbara. She was his childhood sweetheart. He met her when she was barely 13 and he was 17. She gave birth to their daughter, Linda, when she was 18, but they didn't get married until Linda was 6 years old. And it was a deep and a lasting love. I think on some level they loved each other until the day Sam died, but it was not an easy love and it was not an uncomplicated love, and they had what today might be called an open marriage at the end, and it wasn't a happy marriage. So when Vincent died, I mean, this is the worst thing that can happen to any parent, obviously, the loss of a child. And even with Sam's question about the parentage of the child, it just devastated him. He blamed himself because nearly all his friends had told him to put a fence around the pool, and he said it would spoil the look of the estate, which really was an estate at 2048 Ames in Los Feliz, just below the planetarium, or in that area.
In Los Angeles, yeah.
But he also blamed his wife for not watching, keeping better watch over the kids. And but interestingly enough, for someone as eloquent as he was, as expressive as he was, a voracious reader, someone who read everything, everything under the sun, he found it difficult or almost impossible to express his feelings except in his songs. And all of his friends, the people I talked to, Lou Rawls, who had grown up with him, J.W., Barbara, I mean, they said he was just devastated in a way they'd never seen, but he never spoke of it. He just went off to his room by himself.
Let's let the music do the talking. You mentioned earlier the 1963 Nightbeat album. There's a cut on there, Lost and Looking. Shows the tenderness, that delicacy, that depth of voice of and feeling, and Sam Cooke's range. You've called this the very definition of soul music, Peter.
Right.
Let's listen to Lost and Looking, Sam Cooke, 1963.
I'm lost and a-looking for my baby. Wonder why my baby can't be found. I'm lost and a-looking for my baby. Lord knows my baby ain't around.
Sam Cooke in 1963. All that tenderness, all that delicacy. Mary's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Mary. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Loud and clear, Mary. What do you think? What's your question?
Well, I had a teacher right here at the University of Iowa. His name is Peter Nazareth, and he taught the first Elvis Presley class in the world.
Okay.
And he still teaches it, and he's a great fan of Mr. Grillman.
Great.
And he told us in one class in the 90s that the mafia was involved with the killing of Sam Cooke and Otis Redding, because both Sam Cooke and Otis were starting their own label. And Otis Redding's plane was brand new, so it wasn't any reason for the plane to crash.
And
it's all involved in this sex, race, and eroticism.
Let us pick it up, Mary, and thanks for your call. Peter, Sam Cooke's death, remind us of the circumstances of it, and then speak to Mary's question, if you would.
He was killed in a motel. He had gone there with a young woman named Lisa Boyer, a prostitute. She ran off with his clothes and money. He believed she had gone into the motel manager's apartment office. He banged on the door. The motel manager, Bertha Franklin, said, "You know, you got trouble, you call the police. I'm not opening this door." He knocked the door down, and in the ensuing struggle, he was shot by the motel manager. But I, you know, I think much more significant than his death is the reaction within the black community and the fact that to this day there's almost universal belief that someone who was so shining a light could die in this fashion. I think it's a tribute.
You mean disbelief?
The disbelief, yeah.
And of course, Mary raises the mob conspiracy theory here. Did you look into it?
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, I could have had a 50 or 100-page appendix to the book with all of the theories which I encountered about Sam's death. Now, none of them came accompanied by any evidence, and they contradicted each other to a large extent. I mean, some of them had people close to Sam, a variety of people close to him having him killed. Many of them had the mafia having him killed. Some had the Las Vegas mob having him killed because although he never played Las Vegas, he said he wouldn't play ball with them. But all of them revolved around what Mary spoke about. It was the idea, the central idea, that this was a case, yet another case, of a strong black man cut down by the white establishment that simply didn't want to see him get any bigger.
We can understand that way of seeing it. Did you end up believing about his death? Did you see reason to believe that view of what happened or not?
Like almost everybody who was close to Sam and everyone who was close to Otis Redding, the family, the people who were the friends, the people who were closest to him and to each of them and who knew them best, I think that the official version is very close to the way it was. I had access to the private investigator's report, which nobody had seen before. It went into a great deal of detail about the circumstances of the death, about Elisa Boyer's modus operandi, mm-hmm. about all of the circumstances surrounding it. But again, I would say that idea that you know, that Sam was cut down by a conspiracy, by essentially by racism, is a mm-hmm. totally understandable idea. I mean, as it reflects mm-hmm. both upon the prevalent racism of that time and the racism that continues to this day. And who knows? You know, maybe somebody is going to call up next or walk into your studio, and they'll have evidence not only showing who killed Kennedy, but how Sam – I mean, in other words, you can't rule out anything. You can't prove a negative. But I looked into this very closely, and the point is that among those who knew him best, Sam best, both his family and friends like J.W., they are saddened. They, you know, see it as no less tragic than anybody else, but they believe that it happened this way because this was the way, part of the way that Sam lived, and there were no apologies about it.
Peter, I want to ask you, we've just got a couple of minutes left, and we're going to go out with his great civil rights era anthem, A Change Is Going to Come. Talk to us about the origins of this song, what he meant it to be.
Well, to begin with, it grew out of Sam's experience and the experience of every black man and woman in the 20th century, and the experience of someone who observed, felt, and felt keenly that experience. It grew, obviously, also out of the civil rights movement, out of the March on Washington, and out of the entire movement. There were two other things it grew out of, though. One was that J.W. Alexander gave Sam a copy of The Freewheeling Bob Dylan in the summer of 63, and on that album was the song Blowing in the Wind, and when Sam heard it, he said, it almost makes me ashamed that a white boy should have written this. I should have written a song like that myself. And he did sing that, Blowing in the Wind, subsequently. I mean, it was a song that meant a lot to him.
Yeah.
Then in the fall of 63, he was arrested for refusing to be turned away from an all-white motel in Shreveport, Louisiana. And that, within a month of that event, he wrote A Change Is Going to Come.
And it resonates right on to this day. Peter Grelnick, joining us from Chicago. It's been a great hour. An hour is not enough. Sam Cooke's story is too big, and your telling of it is too rich and deep. We're really grateful to you for taking the time to put this book together and to share it with us, with all your observations on his music, the man himself. Thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks so much. It was great to be with you, and I want to say that working on the book has been a thrill from start to finish. I've never enjoyed anything more.
Well, we can hear it. We hear it in the music. We read it in the lines. Peter Grelnick, author of the new Sam Cooke biography, Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. We'll go out with A Change Is Going to Come, recorded in 1964, released after Sam Cooke's death in 1965. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
But I know a change gon' come. Oh, yes it will.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.